Hello, and welcome to this week's episode of Ukraine Calling. I'm Bohdan Nahailo for Hromadske Radio in Kyiv, and as always, we're bringing you our feature interview, followed by some new music from Ukraine. This week, our guest is Oleksandr Danilyuk, who last week was dismissed as the Minister of Finance. We discuss with this internationally respected young reformer why he was removed and the state of the reform process generally. Moving on now to music. We're crazy, not mad, just free. My bozhevilni, ne skazheni, a prosto vilni. This is a line from the lyrics of Kyiv's Voice Me Den, Day 8, a pop rock band.
Чути знов свою збрехню, дістали люди, що несуть маячню, розчинитись хочеться, все світі зникнути. У кожного є своє зона враження, не чіпай мене, бо прийде війна.
It's from their song called Vilni, which means free. The vocalist is Oleksandr Viter. His last name means wind. The percussionist is Denis Balikhin. Enjoy. Well, I'm delighted to welcome you to our latest edition of Ukraine Calling for Hromadske Radio in Kyiv. And we're very fortunate to have as our guest this week Oleksandr Danilyuk. Until a few days ago, he was the prominent Minister of Finances of the country, but suddenly had to leave, was dismissed, not of his own will, and made some very pertinent statements about the conditions in which he was forced to take this step. So I hope that today we can shed some light on the actual circumstances in which this departure of a key reformer within the government of Ukraine has happened and allow us to draw certain conclusions. Welcome. Shall I call you Mr. Minister, Mr. Ex-Minister, or simply Alexander?
Alexander is much better.
Thank you, Alexander. Well, let me begin by saying that I've looked at your biography, obviously, to prepare for this interview. Very impressive. You come across as one of the younger generation of people that inspired hope after the Revolution of Dignity. Hope that finally professionals and reformers had come to the helm. How did you move from the private sector, from academia, from your impressive background to becoming a minister? Was this out of a sense of duty or simply because the job was there?
Clearly that was something inside me that something was calling to actually come and work for the country in this important moment.
And this was in 2016, the spring.
Yes, in 2016. Actually, prior to that, I work in the presidential administration as a deputy head of presidential administration, and I was working on the reform agenda. I was the president representative in the cabinet of ministers and supported the team of reformers in the government at that time. As a representative of the president.
But did you have the support that you expected, say 6 months, a year into your job? Did you feel that you were getting sufficient support from the presidential administration, from the government itself? Or did you at some stage feel that you had become stranded out there?
Look, when I came to my position as a minister, I had a right expectations. I didn't have rose glasses, right?
Realistic.
I was very realistic. So, and that was very important, right? Not to have these naive expectations. So we were planning reforms in Ukraine. It's going not ideally, not that's how you want it to happen. So when you plan something, you also plan how to make sure that nobody would stop the reform. It's not like you have a wonderful idea how to do it. You select the perfect model for the healthcare or education, or whatever. That's how we work with our colleagues for the budget reform. It's not how it works. You know, you need to have a perfect model, but you also need to think how to preserve it, how to implement it. And you know that almost everyone will be working against you. That's a typical model in Ukraine. Unfortunately. So this is not of being just smart, right? It's actually being a fighter in moving things forward and having team near you and having colleagues near you who actually can be as an ice cracker, you know, move things
but
forward.
Is this because of the mentality inherited from the Soviet period? Is it because of vested interests in corruption, wanting a piece of the cake before anything is done, or, you know, greasing the palms, as the Americans say? What is at the bottom of these obstacles to reform?
Everything. There is not one. It's clearly vested interests, right? It's one of the most biggest obstacles. Second is, absence of desire actually to do things.
Political will?
Political will also is, because sometimes what is actually claimed is not what you see in reality, right,
exactly.
Publicly. And obviously, another issue which is very difficult to tackle, even if you have political will is a weak institutional capacity to implement things. At the same, we were moving on the several reforms at the same time, and clearly we don't have that many people capable of doing that successfully. And
we are losing a lot of people because of the brain drain, or not?
This is overall brain drain in Ukraine. That's true, it's happening. But also if you look at the state sector, this is where it's especially painful, right? Because you see people who actually can do things, they're losing their motivation. And this is very painful because you understand that with the rest, you cannot do it. You need to have a critical mass of people who moves ahead. That's why I was very sad of seeing people from the previous government, reform-oriented, leaving.
Yeah.
And they don't want to return. This is a very bad message. This is a very bad message. And this is, when I was sacked last week, you know, for me it's also very important not to send the message that that's it. You know, because there are still people around who are doing things. Yes, you know, we work together, we were helping each other, but they need to move on. Otherwise it's a full stop, reverse.
That's a very generous and principled position, and that's been noticeable in your behavior. Tell us about the importance of, or the impact, the weight of external, shall we say, motivation, the conditionality that has been built into providing credits and political support. To what extent was that a driving force rather than political will?
Very good question. Well, short answer, and that's what drives changes in the country. It's a short answer. But if you look at how it evolved during the 4 years, of the last 4 years, for example, initially, everybody, for somebody was like IMF or World Bank. That was, you know, meaning that it has to be done. Then approximately 2 years later, so in 2016, when our government came, was formed, the public tired. They said, like, why do we want the government, right, if, you know, they do what others want us to do? And even if we understand it's the right thing to do, publicly we couldn't communicate this because people are just tired. Why do we have a government then?
Well, they weren't just tired. We have very widespread populism, right, as a political weapon, and it's very easy to dump on, to criticize.
That's true.
Without providing alternatives.
This is very true, but, you know, this is two different things. Populism, you're absolutely right. I should have actually mentioned first. But second is, you know, Ukrainians want to have a government that are capable of doing things without outside pressure. So obviously we changed the rhetorics. We're saying we're doing it for the Ukrainians. And we did. But I can tell you as an insider, yes, that's how we were communicating. But if it wasn't for the external pressure, those would remain only the words, right? But, you know, the really conditionalities works. Anti-corruption court adoption it of the last week, it was because it's a conditionality for IMF tranche, period.
Okay, but for our listeners to understand, and some of them listen in Ukraine too, the proposals, the reform agenda that is given to Ukraine from outside, is it one that serves 100% the interests of the Ukrainian people and the state for the future? Or is it self-serving to some extent in terms of what is expected of Ukraine, in terms of its resources, in terms of where it's seen to fit into the economic model of relations? In other words, for those listening, is the support that is given to us as altruistic, as generous as it is, as it seems, or are there some, shall we say, more sinister elements connected to the conditionality? I'm asking this because you often hear this in the streets. People say, oh yes, they're giving us loans, but we'll be paying for 20 years or 30 years, and they just want to use us as a base for getting resources out of, etc. What would you say?
Again, very valid question. Based on my experience, obviously, this is a genuine desire to support Ukraine. And especially the package of support, financial support, that we are currently using, and it is expiring actually very soon in March next year, was formed at the most difficult time in our recent history, right? So it was 2014, 2015, where we, as a result of the war, of the economic, military aggression, as a consequence of the, of revolution, obviously, we needed support, and that package was put in place, and there was a genuine desire to support the country. So I understand where all these messages come from, but they have no grounds. But what is what should be expected from the every government official who works with this organization is to protect the interest of the country. That's, you know, I wasn't an easy person. I have excellent relationship with IMF, with the World Bank, with Group, right, with EBRD. But in each of these institutions, I had a very strong stand on some of the issues. I said, no, that's not going to work. We're against that. Because we treat your money as money of our taxpayers. I don't care. You know, we should not waste money of our taxpayers. We should not waste your money, right? If it's loaned, so what? We're going to repay it. So this is, I was a very, very tough negotiator sometimes, right? But actually, in that attitude, that approach actually builds the trust, because they see on the other side, it's not just weak people who are desperate. And
you're
they
serious
just,
partners.
And that's what is important. You know, who you respect in your life, in professional life, is people who are actually partners with you, right?
But critics would say, and they do say that, and they ask, why have we not seen very substantial, deep, radical reforms? What we've seen are either a kind of lip service paid to external creditors and donors, and cosmetic changes, or changes that at the last minute have the guts taken out by the people that are, imposed to run the institutions or bodies that are created in the so-called reforms. This may be an exaggeration, but how do you see this situation?
Another very good question. Another very good question. I was asking this question all the time, how to break this vicious circle. Well, reality is that as a result of revolution, we didn't have a radical change of elite, right? You know, we have people who have been before and didn't deliver. If it's old people, they also link to each other, right? They link to the business elites. You know, they have this pretty much, it's a, again, people, yeah, they're slightly younger, but mentality similar sometimes. And obviously, with the exceptions of some ministers who actually were coming, you know, out of blue, right? You know, as a technocrats, they really were committed to do the changes. So that's one of the explanations. Second is those people, they like the balance. Ukraine is, I call it, a perfectly balanced country, where it's so difficult to change something, because if you change something, immediately you pull a string that touches other people, and they're trying to pull it back to keep the balance.
Some would say that balance equates status quo.
Yes, so difficult to break. So you need to be destroyer, but in a constructive sense, because you need to, you know, those links needs to be broken. Because there are still monopolies, there's oligarchs impacting the politics, impacting the having influence on the media, actually. Media
are
is
they
driven
still
by
as
them.
Powerful as they were 3 or 4 years ago?
They're less powerful.
Particularly in the energy sector, where are they less powerful?
Look, I'm just overall,
yes.
They are less powerful, but they're still very powerful. Because look, if you look at the, for example, what is important for the elections, right, is financing. And access to media.
Control of the banks?
Control of the banks. Yeah, we've passed this. I know what you're hinting to. But it's, you know, I think we resolved that issue.
Good.
But look, main media owned by oligarchs, right? And this is, you can see how they position, you know, who they support. This is clearly a biased approach. And new people will not have access to it. No way.
And the new parties. You've linked your own stance, the very principled one, to an attempt to take away from the control of the ministry a key element that could provide political backing, financial encouragement during the elections that could be used for political purposes.
That is absolutely true. Look, I understand that this is not just a job to be a minister of finance. I don't need to do it professionally. I need to be, and professionally it means that I need to be neutral, right? I need to make sure that the money is spent efficiently, you know, and they're not misused, because it's not our money, it's taxpayers' money. But I also understand that this is my historical time, right? And I understand that if that country, this country, our loved Ukraine, needs to change, and for that, new people should come. The balance should be changed as well. There need to be new people with new values. They need to have access. And at the same time, the old system could use the money from the budget to secure those who are in power, or secure those MPs that are currently in the parliament, because they use this money and then they have a competitive advantage, right? They have administrative resource and they have competitive advantage vis-a-vis new people. And this is just not just the role only of the Minister of Finance. I'm just thinking, look, this is just unfair. Right? We need to think about the country. We need to think how what is necessary for it to change. And whatever stops it needs to be blocked at all costs.
So when was the moment when you realized that you could not put up with it anymore, that you had to speak out?
Well, actually, I was quite vocal. All my tenure, actually. In the first day, I said that I will be fighting very hard, right? Nobody will stop me on state fiscal service reform, on the tax police reform. I was vocal, but at that time, you know, people thought that I'm not serious. And then when it actually comes to decisions, I was the first one who attacked the corrupt head of state fiscal service, Roman Nasirov. And I had so many people with top officials. They say, don't do it. You know, that violates the balance. Why do you do it? Do you want to him imprisoned? That's not... And I'm just thinking, like, it's a club. I'm not a member of the club. I'm a minister of finance. And this guy is head of the important state organization that collects taxes. He needs to be not member of the club. He needs to work for people. He needs to be not, you know, he should not be corrupt. He should be professional.
More of a cartel than a club.
Similar situation, exactly. Well, you said this. But yeah, you're right. And similar situation with Prosecutor General. Nobody ever had the conflicts with Prosecutor General in this country because he's very powerful. You know what? I don't care. I don't care because I believe it's an old institution that keeps Ukraine, moving slow, right? And it still suppress businesses, it suppress civil society. It's what's happening. That's what people are talking about. And that's what I experience in my job. So I would never accept just closing my eyes and keeping my position, right, thinking about security of my position, ignoring this. No.
You obviously weighed up the risks and political price that you would probably have to pay by turning, appealing, as it were, to the G7 ambassadors, voicing your concerns. Is that to be interpreted as a plea for support and understanding from outside, or was it a broader signal to society and to people of your generation, reformers, look what's happening, help, SOS, let's try and mobilize and do something about the situation? Or am I reading too much into it?
You know, actually, there is some background, you know, and we don't have time to cover it, so I don't want to oversimplify it, but I'll try to give you a couple of messages. First of all, all of these ambassadors had some very direct relationship to the reform of state fiscal service. This is the one that I'm moving forward and I'm being pushed back. You know, I'm not, it is blocked from all sides. And they've been the members of supervisory board for that reform. And they knew how I fought. They knew how critical it is for me. And we used the money of that country's donor money, technical support, loans, actually to reform state fiscal service. So it was my duty, first of all, to tell them, you know, it's happening because of state fiscal service. There's, you know, your money is being used and the things are not moving forward. And actually, you know, I cannot move any farther. It's A. And B, also have a very good relationship with the ambassadors, and they know how difficult it was for me, and they will tell me, you need to stick around, you need to push things forward. And obviously, when they got in the news, the message that there could be a resignation, they were concerned. And I didn't want them to feel that this is just, you know, for them to understand the real reason. Because otherwise, they rely on this. We have a trust. So I had to do it. And that was my, like, maybe, you know, the last resort, because I exhausted all other options. Okay, that was done. And I think it was the right thing to do.
And you also said publicly, I will not resign.
I will not resign because I'll never give up. Good. I'll never give up. If somebody wants to get rid of me, good luck. Do it. But it's not because I'm weak. I will be fighting till the end. Why? Because I believe that what I was doing, my team, my colleagues were doing, is very important for the country.
Were you disappointed by the vote? Obviously, the vote to dismiss you, which the Prime Minister had... he'd brought in the proposal that you be fired on the same day that the anti-corruption court was passed in its second reading. So you were kind of slipped in the back. Your issue was slipped in the back door. One issue went through, but the more contentious one remained with us. What did you feel? Were you disappointed that so many deputies actually voted for your dismissal, knowing your record? Personally,
look, I look at the parliament. I know all of them. I know who is good, right? I know who is bad. I wasn't disappointed. No, I just see it's, you know, everybody reacted in the way they should react. That reflects the quality of the parliament their principles.
Did they react per a scenario that was worked out in terms of the voting?
It was everything was pre-agreed. That's how the parliament works. No surprises, everything pre-agreed. There were some deals done. If you vote for Minister of Finance resignation, you know, you will get such and such, right? Either financial support or something else. Or, you know, we will give you such and such position. So this is like a, unfortunately, it was like a market, right? And I know how it works. And I want the parliament to be different. So looking forward for the next elections, because that is important. That's why blocking the use of the state money to actually to make the elections unfair. We have to do a lot as a country, you know, to change the quality of institutions, including parliament, including the government, right? The country deserves better.
Now looking back, it's only a few days since you left your ministerial post. What do you see as your main legacy in those years that you were there, from April 2016 until June of 2018, in those 2 years? When you look back, say, in 5 years' time, what will you tell yourself? What will you be proud of?
Look, we've done a lot in terms of reforms, midterm budgeting. We fought corruption in the VAT refund area. We nationalized private bank, which is a very dangerous and very complex move that everybody was shutting away, right? Because it was so risky. And other things as well. But I also understand that it's all, you know, the question is where Ukraine will be in 5 years, right? Because if there will be reversal, I will not consider this as a legacy. It's nothing. So for me now, the legacy really is two things. First of all, is the ministry and the team, right? Because when they learn to how to work, you know, to be motivated to change the country, this is inside them, right? This is, nobody will actually then take it from them anymore. And second, I was, since day one, was actively and vocally you know, working against the system. And that actually motivates other people to do the same, right? And this is also, I believe, a legacy. And I'm sure there will be more people like me, and there are people like me, right? And such moves, not being, you know, if something wrong happened or something against you, you just resign. No, we need to fight till the end. And that is a legacy. I want it to be as... that stay as a legacy, because that could help the country to change and other people to behave in a similar way. You know, you cannot be loyal to everything and expect the country to change. You need to be breaking the rules.
Okay, and as a kind of parting message, it can be to your listeners, it can be to your staff that you've left behind. What is your parting thought or call or whatever you want to say in your final response?
Right, you caught me on this.
It's tough. I ask all my guests.
I only can say it's only beginning. For all of us, it's only beginning.
Okay, that's already a powerful statement. This is just the beginning. Alexander, I've been very, very pleased to have you. Alexander Danilyuk, who was until a few days ago the Minister of Finances, who publicly said, "I will not betray my country," and who was prepared to fall on his sword, metaphorically, for the time being, and to set an example. So thank you. Thank you for your position. Thank you for sharing your insights and your experience with us.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Андрію, якщо будеш слухати, запиши. Я тут вставку таку, десь та, тому що це довгі інтерв'ю, там десь посередині знайди місце і встав це. Well, I'd like to remind our listeners that I'm talking to Alexander Danilyuk, this week's guest, until very recently the Minister of Finances, who's discussing with us what is actually happening in the world of reform. Thank you. And looking ahead, well, join us again next week when we'll bring you a topical in-depth interview and some music. So tune in. And we would be happy to receive any feedback from you. Write to us at ukrainecalling@hromadskeradio.org. ukrainecalling@hromadskeradio.org. This is Bohdan Nahailo in Kyiv. Thanks so much for listening.